Listener supported. WNYC Studios.
Mike Peskin for Brian Lehrer on WNYC. Limited government, one person, one vote, checks and balances, separation of powers. These are some of the most celebrated aspects of that most celebrated of American documents, the U.S. Constitution. But you know which phrases aren't even mentioned in the Constitution? Limited government, one person, one vote, checks and balances, separation of powers. So is this an oversight? Is this a designed flexibility? Or is it maybe an aggressive PR agent spinning different articles after the fact? The Unwritten Constitution is what it is, and that's the title of a new book by Professor Akhil Reed Amar, who joins me now. Hello, Professor.
Good morning. Thanks for having me.
So I can't tell you how many office holders and office seekers say, I keep this copy of the Constitution right here in my breast pocket, always the breast pocket, close to the heart. Do you think they know that the document they hold is really so much bigger than the 8,000 words literally contained therein?
Well, I hope they do, because they do all the time talk about just the things that you just mentioned, separation of powers, checks and balances, limited government, federalism. Even the very phrase Bill of Rights doesn't appear in so many words in the document.
But they still don't just – these phrases aren't just something that we invented 10, 20, 50 years later as a society to describe what's in the document. Sometimes they're concepts that sprang out without being literally written, but they were sort of imbued within the document itself.
Absolutely. What this book tries to do is show you that we have to at times go beyond, beneath, behind the words, but we should never lose connection to the written Constitution. We wouldn't want an unwritten Constitution to swallow up all the advantages of a terse text. But the fact that the text is so short does mean that it's not going to mention everything, and so that does have implications for how we have to read the thing. It says Army and Navy, it doesn't say Air Force, but that doesn't mean you can't have an Air Force, or you can't have a bank, or Social Security Administration, or Department of Energy, for that matter.
See, implications for implications. That's what keeps college professors and experts on the Constitution in business. Akhil Reed Amar is the Sterling Professor of Law and Political Science at Yale. Do you think some of the stuff that's unwritten, do you think some of it's a strength that it's unwritten, and there's some instances where it really was a weakness, where maybe they should have been more explicit about what they were talking about?
Well, here's a strength, that it is so short that ordinary people can read it, that its first three words say, we the people, and that's because actually ordinary people 225 years ago got to vote on the thing. And I'm not sure they would have been able to vote intelligently on the thing if it were 100 pages long. So it has to be short in order to be a popular document that remains connected to ordinary people. So we're not probably going to be able to list all the rights that we have. There may be as countless as the stars in the sky. And the Ninth Amendment itself says that. It says the enumeration, the listing of certain rights shouldn't be construed to suggest that those are the only rights. To deny or disparage, is the language of the amendment, other rights retained by the people. So now we have to try to figure out what other rights there might be supplementing, never undercutting, but supplementing the textually enumerated ones. And if we tried to list everything, we probably might have forgotten one, and that right would have been less secure than the way they did it.
And we'd have given the constitutional dough. The idea of the text, of the Ninth Amendment, saying there are these unenumerated rights, saying that this Constitution isn't the only document you have to tell you what rights, does that blow a hole in the theory, or at least the description that is applied to some constitutional thinkers and Supreme Court justices, that they are strict textualists? Can you be a strict textualist when the text itself says, don't think of me as being very strict?
And that's why when we go beyond the sound bites, what I say is, in fact, the following. We are all textualists. We are all living constitutionalists. Because my friends, Justice Thomas and Scalia, I appeared recently at an event at the National Archives with Justice Thomas.
I saw it on C-SPAN, yes.
And he proudly admits that there is an unwritten constitution, and he believes in concepts like federalism and limited government and checks and balances. The trick is to go beyond the Constitution without betraying it. And the book tries to identify ways that we can go beyond the text while really staying faithful to it, because the text itself sometimes invites us, commands us even, to go beyond it.
Right. So from your talk with Professor Thomas, I got the impression that, and you wouldn't get this impression.
Justice Thomas.
Yes, Justice Thomas. I got the impression that he maybe differs from his mentor and great friend, Justice Scalia, in how much of a textualist that he himself thinks he is.
Even Justice Scalia, in his thoughtful moments, proudly says that he doesn't believe in strict construction, but proper construction. And when you have a Ninth Amendment that tells you how the text is to be construed, the enumeration of certain rights shall not be construed, same word as construction, to deny or disparage others. Now, Justice Scalia is a little more skeptical about the Ninth Amendment. Maybe Justice Thomas might be more open to that. But even Justice Scalia writes important opinions in which he says the key work here is being done not by the text, but, for example, by the structure of the Constitution, by our traditions and other things. So he himself, in case after case, has relied on what I'm calling the unwritten Constitution.
And the man using that phrase, the unwritten Constitution, the precedents and principles we live by, is Akhil Reed Amar. He's a professor at Yale. You know, when people hear us talking about this, they probably, and we will get to the idea of the right of privacy, and they're probably thinking about the rights granted by the Constitution. But your book begins with a great part of history that had nothing to do with these high, well, a little to do with the high-minded rights, but basically was the logistics of how to impeach President Johnson, and you had to rely a lot on what was unwritten. Why don't you tell us a little bit about that story?
Yeah, President Johnson, Andrew Johnson, actually began as Vice President Johnson. Let's imagine that he had been impeached when he was the Vice President, and then I'll talk about what actually happened. Now, the words of the Constitution say very clearly that the Senate tries all impeachments, and says very clearly that the vice president presides over the Senate. And if you just took those words literally, that would mean that the vice president presides over his own impeachment. And that can't be right. And I'm not just making that up. That's what virtually all good lawyers and judges, left, right, and center, would say. And so because there are unwritten principles, like the rule of law, the Constitution is law. And one basic idea of the rule of law is a person can't be a judge in his own case. Now, a very similar issue actually arose when Andrew Johnson, President of the United States, was impeached. Remember, Lincoln had been assassinated. There was, at the time, no sitting vice president because Vice President Andrew Johnson had stepped up to become President Andrew Johnson. He's impeached. The Senate is the court of impeachment. And a senator, in the very first hour of the impeachment trial, is about to be sworn in, and people object. And they say, he's about to be sworn in, and people say, you can't sit as a judge in this case. Why not? Because you actually, under the succession rules and under the statutes at the time, you're next in the line of succession. If Johnson is convicted, you're going to move into the White House, and so you actually have an improper conflict of interest. Now, there were arguments on the other side as well. Gee, there are only two senators from Ohio. If I have to step down, then Ohio is being deprived of its equal share of the Senate. And back and forth they went. And the text didn't answer all the questions. They were arguing about first principles of the structure of the Constitution as a whole.
And if that hadn't come up, we might not have had a definitive answer, as much as we could call what happened and how it played out during the Johnson impeachment definitive. Are there other examples like this, big questions about procedures that the Constitution alludes to but doesn't spell out?
Yes, the Constitution doesn't say in so many words whether a president can fire cabinet officers at will. It says that he can appoint them, and the Senate has to agree to that to confirm the nomination. But it doesn't say anything about the firing process, the disappointment process, if you will. And if you just look at the text, you could say, well, gee, the Senate had to agree to appoint, so it has to agree to fire. That's actually what Alexander Hamilton seemed to say in the Federalist Papers, Federalist Number 77, but that's not the way it's worked out. From George Washington on, it has been clear in our system that presidents have a right to fire cabinet officers at will. And the first Congress signed off on that. That's called the Decision of 1789. On issue after issue, especially about the presidency, what matters more today is not what the text says about Article 2, because the text isn't so detailed. It actually counts much more what George Washington in fact did. he got to fire, if he wanted, Alexander Hamilton, who was Secretary of the Treasury. So that means Barack Obama could fire Geithner at will, or Paulson before him. George Washington negotiated treaties without getting Senate pre-approval, so today's presidents can do that. George Washington unilaterally recognized the French revolutionaries as the new government of France, and so Jimmy Carter can recognize the Taiwanese government, or Barack Obama can recognize the Libyan rebels. At some point, he may recognize the Syrian rebels. On issue after issue, when it comes to presidential power, what matters more than what the text says is what George Washington did. Just like Christians that may ask themselves, what would Jesus do? Presidents rightly ask themselves, what would George Washington do? What did George Washington do?
So why is all that stuff, everything that the presidents after Washington did, why would that fall under the rubric of unwritten constitution and not just the rubric of following precedent?
Well, precedent is part of unwritten. When I say unwritten, I don't mean it's not written somewhere.
Right.
Cases
probably
are written, but it's not in that 8,000-word document that I carry around in my breast pocket, too, and that you say, you know, politicians like to claim that they carry around. I would love it if they not just carried it around, but read it every so often.
Well, whenever I meet a politician, I'll start the frisk procedure to see if he actually does that. But the idea is that the unwritten Constitution goes beyond the concept of legal precedent, though it includes it. It goes beyond the concept of stare decisis, though it includes it. It incorporates many of our other founding documents as well. It includes, and you write about it, goes up through Martin Luther King's speech about having a dream.
And the Declaration of Independence, and we already mentioned the Federalist Papers. We could talk about landmark, iconic cases like Brown versus Board of Education. We could talk about the Gettysburg Address. We all are Americans, and Americans share a set of special texts, canonical, iconic texts that really define the American creed. And we all believe these, whether we're red or blue, R or D, conservative or liberal, north, south, east, west. And the Constitution is one of the things that we all have in common, but there are these other great texts like the Declaration of Independence, like the Gettysburg Address, like the Federalist Papers.
Okay, so let's compare a couple concepts. One is still very controversial to this day, and people accuse judges of finding a right in the Constitution that wasn't there. But the one I want to talk about first isn't, and it's the concept of innocent until proven guilty, not in the Constitution.
Exactly. And proof beyond a reasonable doubt isn't in the Constitution, and yet everyone today, Justice Scalia, Justice Thomas, Justice Alito, all believe that to be true. Here's another related example. At the time of the founding, no American was allowed to take the stand in his own defense, in his own criminal trial. And the text doesn't say that a criminal defendant has a right to take the stand. And at the founding, in no state court could you do it in America, and you couldn't do that in the early federal courts. No defendant had that right. Today, every defendant has that right. Every justice believes that. Justice Alito's first opinion for the court, when he joined the court, was an opinion based on the right of a criminal defendant to take the stand.
Did some justice, quote-unquote, find that right, or did it just become the practice? Like you say, it wasn't a part of the civil code. People were seen as biased if they took the stand in their own defense.
Exactly.
How did that come to be accepted?
State by state by state, we changed, we evolved. By the time of, by 1900, and Maine was the first state to let criminal defendants take the stand, I think 1854, then a bunch of other states did it, and at a certain point it became the basic American way of life, truth, justice, and the American way. At a certain point it became almost universal, and at that point the Supreme Court, not leading but following, said to the few outlier jurisdictions, get on board. This is now an American right.
Okay,
it's
so
the right of the people. The people themselves every day are exercising and claiming this right in courtrooms across the country.
And the people support it, and the people have shown that they believe in it. But let's contrast that with the right of privacy, which is still controversial to this day. It goes back very far, but, you know, first talked about and made a quote-unquote right in the case of Griswold versus Connecticut. Why is that controversial? Why is that controversial in something like innocent until proven guilty isn't? Or is it one of those circular reasoning? It's controversial because it's controversial, because not everyone has accepted it.
Well, Griswold actually is not particularly controversial. Roe versus Wade is, and let me tell you the difference.
Yeah.
In Griswold versus Connecticut, the justices of the Warren Court, mid-1960s, struck down a Connecticut statute that made it a crime for married couples to use contraception. And other people, too, but even married couples. And what the Supreme Court, in effect, said is, that's un-American. No state in America other than Connecticut has ever done anything like that. And actually, Griswold isn't controversial. So in their confirmation hearings, Chief Justice Roberts explicitly endorsed Griswold, and so did Justice Alito, and so has every nominee since Robert Bork, except Justice Scalia, who didn't want to talk about any past case. So, in fact, in order to get confirmed today, conservative appointees have to pledge allegiance to Griswold. Roe is very different, and Griswold was basically codifying basic American practices. Roe versus Wade, by contrast, only a few years later, about the same vote on the court, much more controversial, and here's why. Roe announced, in the name of privacy, a right against abortion laws that rendered unconstitutional the laws of 49 of the 50 states at that time. Only New York was Roe compliant when Roe came down. So Griswold basically was just codifying actual practices across the land. Roe was way, way ahead of actual social practices. Both cases in the name of privacy, but one was way ahead of the American people, the other one wasn't.
Part of the Roe decision that you write about was the decision itself, which you call kind of sloppy and not really well-reasoned.
Yeah, and I was a big friend of Justice Blackmun's. My brother actually clerked for him, but it was not a well-done opinion at all.
If it were better done, would Roe be more accepted?
Perhaps, and the Supreme Court has dialed Roe back. More states have protected abortion rights on their own, and the abortion right in the Supreme Court has been softened considerably from the rigid trimester framework that Roe announced. So the court and the country are in closer alignment than they were at the time of Roe versus Wade. And the court has also in recent years said, above and beyond privacy, there's another reason why abortion rights might be significant, and that's because of women's equality. And women's equality really is in the Constitution in a stronger way. And so since Roe, the court has emphasized women's equality way more than it did in the Roe case itself.
But even at the time, and I read about this in your book, there were arguments available to Justice Douglas, which he chose not to take up, which might have strengthened his case more.
Justice Douglas in Griswold wrote a kind of sloppy opinion. He concurred in the Roe case. He actually had taught at the Yale Law School, but you know he was actually a kind of sloppy person. The current justices have tried to be a little bit more careful than that.
I want to ask you about slavery. It's the 3/5 compromise is in the Constitution. It allows for slavery. But is there something in the unwritten Constitution? Well, here's a thesis. Tell me if it's fair. Even though slavery is the founding sin of our republic and in the Constitution, is there in the unwritten Constitution this idea that slavery is wrong, even at the time when it was being allowed by the Constitution?
Right. And of course, today we had the 13th Amendment in the culmination of the Civil War saying slavery must end now. So immediately, everywhere, and so universally, and without any compensation even for the slave masters. Even if you were a loyal slave master, loyal to the Union in a Union state like Kentucky or Missouri, Delaware, you have to free your slaves today with no compensation. So that's the 13th Amendment, and it transforms everything. But even before the 13th Amendment, one could say, well, the word slave and the word slavery, those words aren't mentioned in the Constitution.
Right.
But you are right that slavery was protected big time in the Constitution thanks to the 3/5 clause. Now, here's why that matters today. Because the reason that we had the Electoral College was not big state, small state balance. The big state guys won every time. It wasn't that they didn't believe in democracy. They put the thing to a vote, we the people. The reason we had the Electoral College originally was slavery, because without In a direct national election system, the South would have lost every time because it can't count its slaves. But with the Electoral College, Virginia got to count its slaves, although with a three-fifths discount. The three-fifths clause was built into the Electoral College. That's why we originally had the Electoral College. And so there's a good question, should we have it today or should we modify it? Because it's actually a legacy of slavery.
I want to ask you about the 18th and 21st Amendment. I just got done reading Dan Ockrent's book about prohibition. And, he notes it's not only the only amendment ever to be repealed, along with slavery in the 13th. It's the only time it banned individuals. It limited a personal freedom.
Yes.
Okay. I, perhaps from reading this book, got this notion that one of the reasons why prohibition was rejected, it's sort of like when a body rejects an organ. There's just something about the prohibition of alcohol that was not in accord with the Constitution and what the Constitution's about. And I maybe think this about defensive marriage amendments or flag burning amendments, or every year so many senators and congressmen back amendments that just seem not in keeping with what the rest of the Constitution is about. Do you think that there's anything to that, that the Constitution wants to codify some rights and wants to really not address certain other issues?
I think it's actually quite a brilliant intuition. The last chapter of my book, each chapter tries to talk about a different way of going beyond or behind the written document without losing connection with it, without being unfaithful to it. The last chapter is called America's Unfinished Constitution. And it's about the Constitution still to be written, amendments that we might still add to the document. And I say certain amendments would fit the trajectory of the story thus far, and others wouldn't. They'd be like organs that really don't fit the body that we have. And here's what I say. It's pretty amazing. Every amendment, with the exception of prohibition, which was rejected, expanded liberty and equality. We added the Bill of Rights. We got rid of slavery. We promised equal citizenship to blacks and equal voting rights. Women got the vote. In my lifetime, 18-year-olds got the vote. In my lifetime, we abolished poll tax disfranchisement. So there is a trajectory, and certain amendments would fit that trajectory, increasing liberty and equality, and other amendments, not so much. Criminalizing flag burning would be cutting back on the First Amendment. Saying no gay marriage would be cutting back on liberty and equality. Allowing gay marriage would be expanding liberty and equality, and it would fit the story thus far better.
Akhil Reed Amar, author of America's Unwritten Constitution, I want to thank you. We didn't get into the billeting of soldiers, which keeps a streak alive of every time I've ever talked about the Constitution, but I want to thank you very much, Professor Amar.
And if you want to talk about it next time, I'm happy to do that.
Absolutely.
Okay.
And in a moment, from the Constitution to LIPA, a government-esque entity that maybe hasn't held the test of time as well as that founding document. Back in a moment.